Thanks. This is Andy, and I'm going to start out with just going over the agenda real quick. It's going to be two parts. I'll be talking about the scripting client, some common scenarios, a little bit of a troubleshooting section, and some references. And then I'll hand it over to Terry, who's going to be talking about system management issues, some of the reported issues and resolutions, and some of the recent fixes. Moving on to the next slide, number three. Okay. Just as a quick overview for the scripting client, the objective for the scripting client is just to give you a different way to access management functions rather than using the admin console. So you can start, stop, modify servers, you know, run your applications, modify your applications, install and uninstall, create new servers, clusters, anything that you would do through the admin console as well. Some of the challenges, and we'll go over that a little bit more, are TSO versus Telnet, some of the security, scripting language support, and finding the command syntax quickly to accomplish the job that you want to do. There's basically two modes for the scripting client. There's the local mode, and that's where the client is not going to connect to the admin portion of the server, but it's going to go directly against the HFS. You would use that only if the server, for example, is not up and running and you are just not able to do anything with it and you want to make some changes, so you just use the scripting client. Some of the other things that you have to watch out for, though, is that you have to run the shell script on the same node as the server that you want to modify. One word of caution when you're doing that, just be very careful that the server is, that nobody else is actually trying to make any modifications at the same time, because in the admin console, there's a way to handle the file access. In the scripting local mode, it is not. It's going to go directly against HFS, so whoever comes first, and even if it's two at the same time, you don't know what change is going to go in. Which brings me to the other mode, which is remote. Where the client is connecting to the server directly over the TCP/IP, either using SOAP or RMI protocol, and you would use the cont type parameter in the scripting command to tell it if it's either SOAP or RMI. Like I said, it's the preferred mode because if you're making changes by the admin console at the same time that somebody's running the scripting client, then it's as if two people were logged into the admin console. And any kind of a file changes are going to be, checked against each other. Moving on to the next slide. All right, how do you invoke the scripting client? Well, there's different ways to do that. You can do it interactively, where you're passing commands directly at the command prompt, or you do it in batch mode. You can either use a JCL using BPX batch or just the command line and then pass in the command either using the C parameter or placing commands in a file and you call it by the dash F parameter. We'll go into more details about that as well. You can call it with or without security. And like I said before, you can either use SOAP or RMI. SOAP is the default, but some customers are also using RMI. One other thing to note is that when you're invoking the scripting client, every time you invoke that environment, it creates a separate JVM. So, for example, you can call the dash C multiple times in an invocation, but every invocation that you do, even within a batch job or from a script, will create a new JVM. So it can lead to performance degradation, and you can be running out of memory and things like that. So you have to be very careful about that. Moving on to the next slide. Okay, so here are some examples on, we're getting closer to examples on how you invoke the shell script. In version 6, WSAdmin.sh is in two directories within each of the nodes. So it's either in the app server or deployment manager bin directory, or in the app server or deployment manager /profile/default/bin directory. In version 5, you did not have the profile's default bin directory, so there was only one place where you could call it from. But we recommend that you do it from the second location because it will invoke the command line environment first and bring in any other configured step libraries that you may have in your setup command line.sh. Some of the other things you need to be aware of when you're invoking the scripts on TSO is the region size, and that's a big one. Because the user ID that you log in with, that is the one that will determine how much region size you have. And if you have something, for example, that has IEF USI exits invoked as well, that could limit your region size and you may not be able to run the shell script. So make sure that the TSO user ID has a large enough region size, and also make sure that there are no IEF USI exits that could limit that. I'm moving on to the next slide, 7. There's some challenges when you invoke the scripting client in a secure environment, and the main part is that there are really two steps involved in this. The first step is the user ID that you use to log on to TSO or where you telnet in. That's the one that's used to establish the SSL connection to the server. So it's either the application server if you're in a base environment or the deployment manager. If you are in an NSE environment, and the user ID that's passed to the scripting environment then does the actual SOAP connection to the server, and that is the one that's used to perform the admin commands, the real admin commands. Moving to the next slide. So some of the challenges when you have security enabled are that the ID that's invoking the scripting client is not connected to a key ring, because it has to have a key ring connected to that user ID that contains the admin servers, the CA certificates, or the deployment managers if you're in an NG environment. Also, the ID must have adequate access to the config HFS of both the G manager and the base app server. And the administrative user ID, that's the one that you pass in either on the command line or through the properties file, has to have the required authorization and EJB roles defined to allow you to do the things that you want to do within your script. Because if you have the wrong EJB role and you're not an administrator, and maybe, for example, you only are monitor, then you're not able to really deploy any applications. And if you're trying to run that with an ID like that, then you will also run into problems. There is a table in the Info Center that actually describes EJB roles, and that will give you a little bit more information on that. Moving on to the next slide. So here's a little bit more detail about that. Like I said before, you know, the client has to have the server CA certificate in order to authenticate the server. So like I said, either deployment managers or app server CA certificate, and you need to make sure that that ID, so it's either the TSO or the telnet logon ID, has that key ring defined, which includes the certificate. In version 5 and version 6.0, the key ring was referenced in the SOAP client props file or SAS client props file if you're running with RMI. And in version 6.1, that was changed, and it is all in the SSL.clientprops file, so it doesn't matter if you're running RMI or SOAP. And be very careful, because that keyring is case-sensitive. Now, if you're logging on to the admin console, then basically the browser is the client, versus in our shell script, the TSO user ID being the client. So when the server is sending the deployment manager certificate, then a window will pop up allowing you to accept or add that to the browser's key store if you don't have it already. And once that's done, then the SSL handshake between the client and the server is going to take place, and the SSL connection is going to be established. So when you're invoking the scripting client from TSO or Telnet, of course, you know, there's no pop-up that could happen. So you need to make sure that your server certificate is included in the key ring. Otherwise, you will see this kind of error message. It's called JavaLang Illegal Argument Exception Error Opening Socket, and that is an indicator that the SSL handshake failed. In some cases, you may actually get a better message that explains exactly why, but we've seen for some JVMs that it was just, that was the only kind of message that was coming out, and you could just guess at it. All right, moving on to the next slide. So once the SSL handshake is complete, then that's when that user ID that you're either passing in on the command line or in the WSAdmin properties file is used to do the real administrative tasks. And then it goes through authentication, and you need to make sure that it has the right privileges defined for what it is that you're trying to do. And like I said before, the EJB roles and authentication, things like that, are described in a list in the Info Center. Let's see, there was something else I was going to say. Oh, yeah, there's also something called fine-grained security, where you can go even deeper into changing user IDs and saying who is allowed to do what. You can go all the way down to the application level and server level, and that is also described in the Info Center. Moving on to the next slide. Also regarding security, not everybody has RACS, and if somebody else has other CA products like ACF2 or Top Secret, there's some known fixes for those products as well with required by WebSphere, and that info APAR is II13427. So you may want to take a look at that if you're running any of those products. Moving on to the next slide. There are basically five objects that the scripting client is using or function. First one's admin app. That's used for installing, deleting, modify applications, anything that has to do with the application itself. Then there's admin config to modify configurations. Admin control, that does all the controls of starting, stopping servers and stuff like that. New in version 6 is the admin task object that has some built-in administrative functions for server cluster resource management and other things like that. And then there's the help object, help function, that just gives you an overview of what you can do with the admin object. Moving on to slide 13. Now, here's some examples of how you can use the scripting client. Now, mind you, I was using the old Jackal language still, and the supported languages are still Jackal and Jython, but Jackal is being deprecated, and I'll go into that a little bit further down in some other slides. So what I have here is an example using the -c option where you're basically just passing in a command, just one single command. So you can do either wsadmin.sh-c with a single quote and then the $ admin app.list, or you can do a double quote, but then you will have to use escape with a backslash and then do admin app list. Otherwise, it's not going to work correctly because it's going to interpret that ampersand, the $ as a replacement. So if you're running that, the output looks something like this. Connected to the process, you need to see that, and then it says what type of process it is. It's deployment manager, and it was not the base app server, and where what applications are running on it. It's the admin console file transfer greeting and IDT app. Now, if you're entering it incorrectly, for example, you're using the double quotes, but you forget the $ in front of it, you will get an error message like WSX7015EZ, and it says, it retells you the admin app list is not a right command. If you are doing the WSAdminSH with a double quote and the $ without escaping it, what I found is you're not getting any message and you don't know what's going on. It's just not doing anything because it was replacing it with nothing, and for some reason it was not even recording that as an error. So moving on to the next slide. Now, the next command, the -s, is when you are actually calling up a file. And that's the most commonly used scenario. You know, you want to do a deployment. You want to do the full thing from start to finish, you know, listing applications, seeing what you have, try to, you know, replace another application, do the save at the end. So you just create a script, and you call that script with the -f option. So what I have here is I passed in the user ID and the password for the administrator ID directly on the command line. You can do it in the wsadmin.properties, and you don't have to pass it on the command line. But if you want to do it that way, you can do it, like I said, you know, -user and the -password, -F, and then you're calling the full, you have to have the full path of your script in there. I did not put in the contype, as you can see, because it was just assumed. The default is contype SOAP, and the default scripting language is also Jackal, so I did not change that. So I created a Jackal script on my PC, and I transferred it in binary, and it only contains this one line, and it's called print appandapp.list, and it was basically given the same output as the previous -c example. Now, it depends on how you're creating your Jackal script or your JSON script, and you may need to set a Descript encoding option, Java option, in that when you're calling it, depending on how you created it, because if you're creating it on the PC and you are not transferring it correctly, then you will get all kinds of error messages in there. So there is a tech note that describes exactly what you need to do. Moving on to the next slide, 15. The other thing is to try and find the command syntax quickly of what you're trying to do. Instead of having to go through the whole info center and figure out what, you know, what commands you need to do to find what. It has a lot more examples now. It's getting better. It's probably not quite there yet, but it is actually getting a lot better. And you can always recommend any new examples. If you see anything, you can always let us know, and we can add those to the example section. I have a reference section at the end of my presentation that has a few of the tech notes in there and points you to some of the references for some of the command syntax. The new object admin task provides the pre-built functions for certain tasks. Like I said, it's changing the host name, system name of a cell, things like that. And that's kind of convenient, better than trying to have to do the admin config and try to figure out those commands yourself. In version 6.1, they created what they call the console command assistance in the admin console, and that allows you to drag some predefined admin tasks from the tool and drop them into a script. So basically what you will do, you will run a command from the admin console, and if you have admin command assistance, the console command assistance enabled, you will be able to click on something, and it will show you the command that is just sit under the covers. There's some more information in that in the Info Center. And the next slide will contain a screenshot of what it would look like if you do have the command assistance enabled. You will see on the right side of your admin console something called command assistance. And if you have that clicked, and what I did was I was just starting a server. So it will pop up. It will allow you to actually click on that link. And if you click on that link, going on the next slide, please, it will show you the command that it issued under the covers. And you can take that one and cut and paste it into a script, and basically you just use that as a template and modify it any which way you need. You need to be aware that it's only one command at a time. So I think they're working on making it so that you can do multiple things and it will actually record all the messages at the same time. There's some other tools that will allow you to do that also. But the command assistance for just a quick and easy thing is actually pretty good. Moving on to the next slide. Like I said before, in version 5, it was mainly Jackal that was used, and you may have some old scripts. If you have a lot of scripts that you use for deployment, for example, and they're all in Jackal, you don't want to convert them all to JSON by hand. What you can use is that conversion tool. It's called Jackal to JSON, and I put in the link where you can download it. And you can just run that tool over your existing Jackal scripts, and it will convert them to JSON. There's some cases where it may not work completely, so you definitely want to take a look at it after you convert it and make sure that everything's all right. And you may have to make a few manual changes. But in general, for the main part, it actually works pretty good. moving on to the next slide, 19. All right. Now, some of the problems that we've seen that come up all the time is that the admin ID is not authorized, or that the ID that's invoking the scripting client, meaning the TSO or telnet ID, is either missing the server CA certificate or the private key. We've seen that before, too. So you see the certificate, but it does not have a private key. Or the ID does not have a key ring, or it is missing read access to the list and list ring facility in RACF. Moving on to slide 20. So if the admin ID is not authorized, it's either missing or it's incorrect. For example, I just used an ID that does not really exist. You will get a message saying that it cannot establish the SOAP connection to that host because authentication failure. And it really is a good message because it does tell you what is wrong with it. And it will not really connect to the server process because the SSL hand, the user ID is just not allowed to do anything. Okay, I think we can move on to slide 21. That's the one that we see the most, is that the user ID that you use to log on to TSO or Telnet in does not have a key ring. If that is the case, then you will see messages like that one up here, the error creating SOAP connection to host, and it says connector not available exception, and it will not connect to the server process. Sometimes you will get a little bit more explanation about that, but in most cases you would have to have tracing turned on, meaning SSL tracing or WSAdmin tracing, and both most of the time to really see what is going on. Moving on to slide 22. So if you do have a trace, you may want to take a look for that message, JavaLang illegal argument exception, error opening that socket. That is the message that indicates that the SSL handshake failed if you don't have SSL tracing involved. Moving on to slide 23. Some of the other problems that we've seen is that the key ring name was created with quotes. So it looked like it was okay when we were doing the list ring and did not notice that it was just these single quote, so you really need to make sure that the key ring that you create is the one that you reference in your properties file, in your props file. And to see what the key ring looks like, you just use the RACD cert list ring with the ID for whatever user ID you are using. The other thing is the private key is missing or it is incorrect. And the target mappings were not defined correctly, which could cause application errors. There was an older APAR that had more details about that one. Moving on to slide 24. There's some references that are pretty good. Using the JSON scripting language with WSAdmin is a very good white paper. The other one is the WSAdmin primer. It really goes over more of what you do with the admin client, how you use it. It gives some different scenarios, and that's a very good reference. Even though it says for version 5, it still holds true for version 6. There's just a few things, like I guess, that the props file has changed because it's now the SSL client props in version 6.1, and 6.0 is still the SOAP client props and the SAS client props file. There's some other tech notes that I thought were probably interesting also on mixed nodes. If you're running in mixed nodes environment, how do you work with WSAdmin? Some of the security-related tech notes, the encoding tech note that I mentioned before, depending on how and where you create your JACL script. And then there's some references for examples that are pretty good. And from there, you can actually keep going and look for different examples. In that reference section, it just has a whole list of different things that you can do, and you can go from there. I'm moving on to slide 25. There's some other articles in the Info Center. Also, there's some configuration examples and some security-related Info Center articles. Moving on to slide 26. And I think that's it for me, and I will hand it over to Terry, who's going to be talking about system management issues.
Okay, thanks, Angie. Again, my name is Terry Farrar. Excuse me. Now, Angie has explained the scripting client, and she gave some very good examples of ways that you can access the system management functions without the use of the administrative console. But what I intend to do here is to show some of the latest common non-defect issues that have been reported against the system management component of WebSphere on ZOS. And I'll also go through the steps that were taken to resolve these issues. Now, I'm hoping that this will get you familiar with these issues and also serve as somewhat of a vehicle to provide you with some gotcha-type situations and scenarios that you can keep in mind in the event that you may encounter some of these same types of issues on your local system. Now, towards the end of my presentation, I did also include some of the latest fixes that have been made available for the system management component of WebSphere on ZOS. So if we move to slide 26, the first issue I wanted to mention is where we had a customer who reported that startup of his server failed with message BB00037E, stating that the IWMQ INS function failed with return code of 12. So in investigating this, we found that this customer had specified the start command in the general properties panel of the server. Where this field is located is on the administrative console. If you click on servers, select one of your servers, and then click on Java and process management, followed by a click on process definition and then servant, you will see where you enter that field. So what you want to remember is that for that start command field, you do not want to actually enter the command start. You only want to put the server name there. And on the next slide, 28, I just give an example of what that field looks like when it is populated correctly. Kind of hard to see, but if you look about midway down the administrative console screen here, you'll see that start command field. So moving on to slide 29, we had a customer who reported that the Tivoli Performance Bureau feature was not available under monitoring and tuning. The only options that showed up there for this customer were PMI and request metrics. According to our WebSphere application server V6 documentation, this feature should automatically be available. Now, on our administrative console, certain links are displayed depending upon certain plugins being loaded and available. And this particular link was dependent upon the plugin.xml file showed here, which resides in the com.ibm.ws.console.tpz directory. So to resolve this issue, the customer cleared out his WS temp directory and restarted the server. And by doing so, this plugin.xml file was able to load properly. Moving on to slide 30. I've just shown an example here of what the administrative console looks like when that Performance Bureau option is displayed properly. Down the left pane there, you will see about three-quarter ways down where that feature is there. So moving on to slide 31. While deploying an ear file using the administrative console, the remote location was selected and an error occurred stating that the specified file is not in ear, WAR, or JAR archive. Now, a workaround to this was by downloading the ear file to the local system and installing that way, it would load successfully. We found that this problem was due to the fact that the ear file did not have the appropriate permission bits set. And the reason this customer did not encounter this issue before was because this application was normally installed using WSAdmin scripts. And this did work because the person that was installing the application was actually the owner of the script, so they did not encounter these security problems. Next, on slide 32, we had a page not found error that occurred while connecting to the administrative console, And the deployment manager log also contains a class not found exception and an SSL exception. We found that this problem did not occur if security was disabled. So because of that, we naturally went into investigations on this customer's security configuration. And we found that this problem was due to the misconfiguration of the SSL certificates and key rings. Angie spoke some on these, the configuration of these files during her presentation. So moving on to 33. Had a customer who was attempting to run a JACL script called dmamfproc.jacl. And you see in this command, this WSAdmin command, he was using the dash C option incorrectly. And this did result in error message WASX7120E stating that an error occurred while evaluating a JACL expression. So to resolve this, he had to use the dash F option to specify that he was running a file and not submitting commands. You can see what the command looked like when it was entered properly at the bottom of this slide. And again, this is another area that Angie hit on during her presentation. Okay, slide 34. An attempt was made to install a large application in a network deployment environment, and during the upload phase of the ear file, the system went into a hang condition. An error message BB00271E was displayed, stating that the HTTP request exceeded the input buffer. Now, as stated here, this message does mean that the controller could not read the entire HTTP request because this buffer was exceeded. And as a user response, we document that you should increase the value specified on the large data inbound buffer variable and restart the server. And if this error occurs while installing an application, you could try installing it locally from your server. So on the next slide, 35, as a resolution to this, I mentioned info APAR II 13807 titled configuration parameters which must be set when installing large applications on WebSphere ZOS network deployment. Now this info APAR states that this large data inbound buffer must be large enough to hold the entire ear file. So what we did was we had the customer to increase this value, and that did get him past the problem. To increase this, you just navigate to your custom properties under the deployment manager. And if that property is there, you increase it, or if it's not there, you add it as a new property. And this does specify the length of a reusable inbound buffer that's used for HTTP requests larger than 10 megabytes. And it does limit the size of your incoming request. One other thing I want to mention about this info APAR is it was written back during the version 5 and version 5.1 days. And we don't see as much of a problem with this anymore with version 6 because of some updates that were made, some improvements that were made, for example, 64-bit processing. But I did want to keep this slide in here because we do still have several customers running version 5.1, and you could encounter this issue still. Moving on to slide 36. Had a customer who was deploying an ear file, and he saw a message ADMA0091E stating that there was a problem in this application web.xml file. Also got an illegal argument exception stating that the no duplicates constraint was violated. On the next slide, 37, I show an example of what this customer's web, or what this application's web.xml file looked like. Because of the error message he got, we quite naturally went directly to this web.xml file to see if we saw any problems. And sure enough, when we got in there, we did see that there was a duplication there for this role name that's shown that's highlighted on this slide. So to resolve this, he simply removed one of those row names to remove that duplication. The next slide, 38, shows the protocol HTTP timeout output recovery variable was set by use of the administrative console. But whenever the server was restarted, this propagated back to the original value. Now, during the startup of this particular server, the transformer was executed, most likely during a synchronization function. And there were no errors in this server log to identify the cause of the behavior that we were seeing here. So we saw that since the transformer was being executed, we had this customer to execute the WSC2N.sh script manually so that this transformer would be executed manually. By running this script this way, we saw that it did indeed receive a Java out-of-memory error. So to resolve this problem, we had the customer to increase his JVM heap size. So what you want to keep in mind here is that in some of our startup procs, we do execute some scripts, sometimes seemingly under the covers. So if you see some behavior similar to this, you might want to try just pulling those scripts out and running them standalone just to ensure that they did complete successfully. Moving on to slide 39. Through the administrative console, we had a customer who went to his WebSphere variables and changed the scope to sale. He found that only his deployment manager node variables were displaying. Now, regardless of which scope was specified, those were the only ones that would show up. We also noticed that his namespace bindings would not appear. Now, this is one of those got-you-type situations I mentioned earlier. We found that on the administrative console, there was a checkbox called Use Default Scope that had been selected. Now, we had the customer to uncheck this box, and after that was done, we saw that these entries did display correctly. On the next slide, 40, I show where this checkbox is located, because many of you have probably been on this panel many, many times and never even noticed that box. So if it did get checked somehow, you probably would not even notice it. So if you see about midway down the panel, there is that box called Use Default Scope. So you want to keep that one in mind, because that one would be quite elusive to diagnose. Next slide, 41. Startup of a customer's deployment manager failed with message ADMR0104E stating that there was a problem with the metadata.properties file. No such file or directory. You also got the traceback that you see here. And this problem was due to a full HFS file system. We have seen this problem pop up in various shapes, forms, sizes, what have you. So what I wanted to mention here is that there currently is a requirement for WebSphere Application Server to handle these full HFS issues more appropriately. Currently, the reason we are not more specific in putting out a message stating that the HFS is full is that there are so many places that we read and write to our HFS that if we were to go in and place checks at every one of these required places, it could cause quite a degradation in performance. But I did want to make mention that this has been reported and it is currently being looked into. Slide 42. We had message ADMA7008E, which showed up in the node agent log while an attempt was made to install an application. Now, this message was a Java IO file not found exception on a temp file. Also got the traceback shown here. Now, if we move on to slide 43, we found that this directory showing up in this error message did not exist on this customer system. The node agent log did show that the temp third variable was set to this directory. Now, this was quite confusing to this customer, because he explained to us that the administrative console had been used to set a custom property to assign a different value for a temp serf. What we found is that when he made this change, he only made it for the deployment manager by navigating to his custom properties for the deployment manager, as shown here. So what we did was we informed the customer that this change is also required for the node agent so that it would also write to the proper temporary directory. By setting this custom property for the node agent, he was able to get past this problem. So moving on to slide 44. After migrating to version 6.1, we had a customer who was attempting to install a large application from the local file system. During the install, a security information pop-up appeared, and if the yes button on this pop-up was clicked, the right panel of the administrative console displayed a page cannot be displayed error. And it was at this point that the deployment terminated. And if this ear file was FTP to the mainframe and deployed remotely, then it was successful. So this customer had to activate the web container transport chains called WC inbound admin and WC inbound admin secure. In version 6.1, the native transport ports no longer exist. And from a migration perspective, we now support what is called script compatibility mode. This problem occurred due to the fact that the web container transport channels were not enabled, and they are required for chunking to work properly in version 6.1. Now, this particular problem was reported by multiple customers, so because this was a pretty tough one to diagnose, I did enter a tech note for this. It hasn't been published yet, but it should be published soon. So whenever this tech note does come out, if you have any questions about this, you can contact me directly. This tech note does contain a lot more details on this, so it will be very helpful if you encounter this situation. Next, slide 45. I had a customer who suddenly noticed that the installable apps directory was corrupted. He saw that there were about 30 applications missing from that directory. So what we had to do was to monitor this customer's activities to try to wait until this problem would occur again. And by doing this, we found that this does occur after the install of a particular application. This problem was caused by an invalid binary URL in that application's deployment.xml file. During this failed install, the customer selected a field called Process Embedded Configuration, which is on the Installation Options panel. What we concluded was that this ear file was imported from one system to another, which brought forth this embedded information. During the install, WebSphere attempts to use that embedded info, which did happen to be an incorrect binary URL for the system that this application was being installed on. So this problem was resolved by installing the application with that box left unchecked. Next slide, 46. After the restart of the deployment manager, we found that not all applications were showing up on the administrative console, and the deployment manager servlet logs also showed error message, BD00223I, showing a fast part exception. And this problem occurred because one of the applications in this configuration had a deployment XML file with a zero length, that had a zero length. To resolve this, that zero length deployment.xml file was deleted and the WebSphere servers were restarted. Next, slide 47. Okay, this is the final issue I was going to mention today. Following an upgrade and maintenance, a blank page was displayed when an attempt was made to access the administrative console. There was also a null pointer exception in the deployment manager log, with the traceback shown here. We found that this problem, which did appear as a Java issue at first, but we found that this occurred because the cache in the WAS home slash configuration directory was not properly cleaned up or refreshed. It was discovered that this directory did contain some cache folders, such as org.eclipse.core.resources and org.eclipse.core.runtime, amongst others. So to resolve this, these files were moved to a backup folder, and the WebSphere servers were restarted. Okay, moving on to the next slide. As I mentioned, that was the last issue. So on the next several slides, I just have shown some of the latest fixes that have been made available for the system management component of WebSphere on ZOS. And I've just placed those here for your convenience that you can look at when you get a chance. We're not going to go through them here due to time constraints. So if we step on to slide 49 and move on to 50, step on up to 51, and finally to slide 52. I've listed some references here that were used in putting this presentation together and putting my portion of the presentation together. You see that I've listed the information centers for versions 6, 6.1, and 5.1. You also want to remember that when you go into these information centers, you want to look at the WebSphere ZOS topics. There is a way to narrow the scope of your search when you're into the information center, so just make sure you narrow it down, or just make sure you are looking at ZOS topics. I've also mentioned the WebSphere application server for ZOS support page that can be found at the link shown here. And that is all that Angie and I had on this for today.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. We will pause for just a moment. And there are no questions at this time. However, I would like to remind everyone that is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. We will pause for just one moment. And there are no questions. I'd like to turn the conference back over to you, Mr. Robertson, for any additional or closing remarks.
At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for our future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, our replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Terry and Angie, for presenting today.